Wednesday night edition of the Dunked On Basketball podcast. Got to get to this Cleveland-Boston game. The expected result occurred, at least by me, since I predicted a sweep. Also, we have been lagging. We got to get to our all-defense picks, Danny and I. And finally, of course, the off-season preview for the recently vanquished Washington Wizards. But first, this is a message to one of our longtime listeners from his friends. From the sunny West Coast to the Big Apple and now our nation's capital, we've seen it all. The early mornings, the sleepless nights, you championed the odds makers and defeated the naysayers. And now you'll carve out a new path forward and show to the world the deity that you are, just light years ahead. Of course, we are talking about Ellie Reginald Weiss. This weekend, Ellie is graduating Georgetown Law, and on behalf of Luna and Michael Farr, we at Dunked On would like to wish you, Ellie, big congratulations on this great achievement. Even though you seldom bought the textbooks and just got outlines from your friends 3 weeks before the final exams, you always tried your best and went out with a bang. We know that you're blasting this program on 1.5x speed as you bike on Mass Ave to and from school and scurry up the CJ stairs into your cozy, lightless bedroom. But we salute you nonetheless and wish you good luck in your upcoming endeavors. Congratulations, Lulu. So that was an interesting congratulations to a law student who's apparently somehow made it through all 3 years and worked really hard, according to his friends.
Well, you and I can speak to the accomplishment that is, because it's something that we both did, even though I never ended up practicing. But yeah, I mean, getting through those 3 years, I've said before that 1L was the toughest year of my life academically by far, and just in terms of overall stress. So to get through that and still be alive, that's great.
Yeah, congratulations also, Ellie, to getting into a way better law school than I did at Georgetown.
They rejected me.
So yeah, his buddy Michael just emailed me and was like, hey, we'd love to buy an ad on the podcast for our friend. And I thought that was a cool idea. So if anyone else ever wants to try that, my email address is in my Twitter profile. I will say anything that you want me to. No, that's actually not true. In fact, Michael's first draft, you will thank me, Ellie, that I rejected it and told him that he had to clean it up a little bit. It was something involving like Morningstar Nuggets, uncontrollable coughs, and bathroom runs. I would never repeat anything like that. All right, let's get to some basketball here. I think that message actually was far more exciting than the actual game between Cleveland and Boston, which was, I don't know, exactly what you'd expect.
Well, I'm going to disagree with you. I thought it was exciting just because LeBron James cutting through a team the way that he did was impressive. And it wasn't.
Yeah, okay.
Close.
It was exciting. It was not dramatic. How about that?
That's fair. And his final line ended up being, to me, less impressive than what he was doing at halftime, because at halftime he had 23 points, but he ended up with 38, 14 to 24 shooting, 9 rebounds, 7 assists, 2 turnovers. You know, standard LeBron James game. But also, Kevin Love got going fairly early, and I thought he did a good job too, but the story is still LeBron James.
You know, Zach Lowe had an interesting point on Twitter, which is one that I think perhaps we should consider, and that is that Cleveland really has not found an opponent other than the Golden State Warriors that's been able to make Kevin Love really paid defensively. And in fact, against a lot of these teams, Love, when they're going against switching smaller defenses, he's actually been able to get into the post and kill guys. Marcus Smart was the latest victim of that. We saw Norman Powell get killed in the last round by Love in the post. And Love was outstanding, dropping 32 points, 16 field goal attempts, 6 of 9 from three, and then he got to the foul line for 8 for 9 as well, as Cleveland shot 35 free throw attempts. And he was awesome. Again, you know, when you see it every time, like when he tried to just post up straight on Al Horford, no dice. But if you want to just switch the LeBron James, Kevin Love pick and roll, and now you've got him in the post against like a Marcus Smart type of guy, like he's going to work that dude. And you can try fronting, but there's so much shooting, it's difficult to get help on the backside. And then you've got LeBron James throwing the pass. He's like an unbelievable entry passer as well. He can lob it over the top, put it into tight windows. So what are you going to do? I mean, we need more ball pressure on LeBron James. Well, now he's going to blow by you. A guy who just tried to switch onto him who's a power forward. That they had a lot of trouble with that. Another thing that I thought really stuck out was they tried putting Al Horford on James. And of course, Cavs Twitter was predictably giving me some shit because last year in the playoffs, I said that LeBron James can't go by anyone anymore. And well, number one, I think he actually looks quicker than he did back then. But number two, the way he's hit his jump shot, now you have to play up on him and he can blow by everyone. I mean, a perfect example of that was like Jay Crowder basically had him trapped in the corner, and he's got to like get right in LeBron's face on that play. And then they also have even more shooting this year than they did last year. I mean, remember last year they're playing Mozgov still a lot of the time, you know, so Kevin Love is one pass away. Kelly Olynyk can't help there, and just LeBron sails in for like an easy, you know, lefty lay-in. Boston just looked so bad, so far away defensively from being able to stop these guys. And, you know, they did hold down the Cavs' three-point shooting in the first half, but and they only shot 2 out of 9, but Boston was 1 out of 15 in the first half from three. And so, I mean, their offense was horrible. The defense was just giving up layup after layup. Olynyk got smoked. Horford was getting worked in ISOs. Love in the post. I mean, really the only guy who didn't get going in this game was Irving. And then, of course, Tristan Thompson. It was unbelievable as well, Danny.
Yeah, he was really strong early in the game, just getting offensive rebounds and really breaking Boston's backs on some of the plays where they played good first shot defense. They didn't play good first shot defense that often, but when they did, oftentimes those possessions did not finish with a rebound, with a stop, with going the other way, because Thompson either got an offensive board or was fouled, which don't count as offensive rebounds, which was frustrating us, but he ended up with 6 in the game and a perfect 7 for 7 from the field, a lot of those being close to the basket on lobs and things of that nature. But he can just really, he is a force offensively, a different kind of force, but one nonetheless.
Yeah, and in the first half, I think he had 5 offensive rebounds and then another one where he drew a loose ball foul. And so the very rare times that Cleveland was missing in that first half, they had 46% offensive rebounds in large part thanks to Thompson. And then Thompson was great defensively. And I thought another thing that, you know, the Celtics got pretty good open shots, especially early in the first quarter, and they weren't hitting those. And then they kind of devolved. I thought the second quarter was really ugly, and they only had 39 points at halftime. Really, their only offense that was effective was Avery Bradley going backdoor. And so, you know, I think they can play a lot better. You know, like LeBron James was unbelievable defensively in the first half. Like, he probably protected the rim like 4 or 5 times. He like made Al Horford, who was shook as hell, like he was missing a bunch of layups inside. Isaiah had this one moment where LeBron stopped him and Isaiah just like tried to shoot the ball up in the air and just like caught it again and got called for a travel. Like, he had no chance. That was reminiscent of like what LeBron did to Curry a few times, blocking him in the finals last year. So it was the big star from last time, Kelly Olynyk, 16 minutes. He had only 2 points. He was 1 out of 6, got in early foul trouble immediately. Marcus Smart fouled out in 21 minutes. I mean, really the only guys that I thought played well in the first half were Bradley and Jaylen Brown, who gave them something. But aside from that, then how much stock do you put into what happened after halftime when the Celtics were able to score better? They had 36 points in the third and then 29 in the fourth, although the game, you know, they were down by 20 for most of that second half.
Not a ton, considering you can't really put that genie back in the bottle in terms of, you know, once a game is functionally over, I feel like you can't really rectify that. But I mean, certainly, yeah, we talked about it at the kind of the what was the end of the Twitter NBA show about the idea of how you handle, you know, what we're looking for from Boston. And their problem early on was not necessarily getting good shots, it was just converting those good shots.
Yeah, and their guys are definitely a lot streakier than Cleveland, who has, you know, great shooters like Love, Irving, J.R. Smith. Channing Frye actually didn't really play at all. They went smaller with Richard Jefferson and Iman Shumpert getting more time. Kyle Korver, who actually was 1 out of 6 in this game, they did a good job on him. But that's why LeBron was able to get all those layups. I mean, it was just a parade ground for him other than threes. I mean, in the first quarter, he was 7 out of 8, and I think every single shot was right at the rim. And they just were not able to load up enough. They're really worried about taking away threes. And then, of course, they got going from three-point range, hitting 9 threes in the second half after only 2 in the first half to outscore the Celtics enough to stay in the lead. I do think they found a little bit of something after halftime. Like, Isaiah was so bad in the first half, I just didn't see him. He was 1 out of 8 in the first half. I didn't see him have the type of burst that we really need. He wasn't getting to the rim. He ganked a couple of layups that weren't as contested as you would expect for him to miss them that badly. He got going after halftime, finished with 17 and 10, but 7 and 19 from the field. The big thing was keeping him off the foul line. They were really trying hard to do that. And then he shot 1 out of 3 on the 1 3 shot foul that he did get in the second half, or might have been actually late in the first half. But a lot of that was just, I thought they were a little shook early on. I think they can play much better offensively. You know, they started working those traps by having Al Horford slip the screen early and then make a play in a 4-on-3. It was a good offensive team. It's just, you know, they don't have the firepower that this Cavs team does, and they have no answers for LeBron James either.
It also is really feels feels like a one-game series now, because if Boston doesn't win game two, then we're looking at something really short, because Cleveland will have that advantage, they'll have the momentum and everything else. So while it's not impossible that Boston can win a game there, I feel like your prediction is going to be very, very close if Boston doesn't win in TD Garden on Friday.
If both of these ends up being sweeps that I predicted, and I got that Celtics in seven right over the Wizards, am I like back tied with you, or will I still be behind?
I haven't done the math yet, but it's probably pretty close.
Yeah, I mean, we clearly need to weight the later rounds much higher, right? I mean, they're just like when you're doing your NCAA tournament pool, right? Like, you get more points for the champion than you do for...
Are we changing? So I see how it is. I see how it is.
Good. I'm glad that you do.
I didn't say I agree with it, and I didn't say we should change the rules midway. I said I see. There's a very big difference there. But yeah, I think I think that there's a fair amount that Boston can take in a positive sense from this, just in the fact that they were getting good looks, but they just don't really have answers for Cleveland's offense. And Brad Stevens, from the quotes that I kind of saw on Twitter and things like that, it looks like he kind of understands that as well, because if you can't defend LeBron James one-on-one, your next option is probably doubling and trapping. He's maybe the single best guy in the league at dealing with that.
Well, I think they can still try going under, which they finally got to. He was one out of six on threes. I mean, I think, you know, if you can get him to like 10 three-point attempts, like, that's, you're doing well there. But no, I don't see any easy answers. I think Stevens does a pretty good job. I mean, one answer is just don't play Tyler Zeller ever for any reason. And he went ultra, ultra small. I think played LeBron at center. They played like Richard Jefferson or something at center in the second half. They brought in Gerald Green to try to boost the offense a little bit. He had 11 points in 14 minutes, 3 of 5 on threes. But I mean, I think the Cavs had kind of stopped trying on defense by that point, because, you know, that's what they do when they don't really need to put out the effort. And another thing I thought was huge was only 8 turnovers for the Cavs as well. I mean, that they're going to, and Boston had 14. Like, Boston has to win the turnover battle to even have the slightest shot in this one. And 4 steals was it for Boston. I mean, they didn't really get any kind of a chance to take advantage of the Cavaliers' shoddy transition defense until it was too late. And the pace in this one was pretty small too. I mean, that the first half numbers, I guess it was about average. Really, it slowed down in the second half, in fact. And Boston did have a 147 offensive rating in the second half, but their problem was the Cavs still had a 127 offensive rating in the second half as well. And it was 61-39 at halftime, and Boston only scored 81 points for 100 possessions. That's just not going to get it done. And their defensive rebound percentage, as we mentioned, was really bad also.
I don't think I have anything more on this game.
Yeah, I didn't see like a ton of chinks in the armor for Cleveland. And, you know, this is a pretty easy path. Oh, here's an interesting question. Brad Stevens said that this is the best LeBron has been playing since Stevens came in the league. He came in the league in 2013-14, which was LeBron's last year in Miami. But I think in particular, Stevens probably is looking back to that first round series that a inferior Celtics team played it against the Cavs that they ended up sweeping. That was the Kevin Love, Kelly Olynyk. Kelly Olynyk, by the way, grabbed someone's arm and got called for a foul in this game in somewhat similar fashion to Love. Not quite as ridiculous as that play. But do you agree that LeBron James is better now than he's been at any point since Stevens was in the league at age 32?
If we're talking about an entire playoff run, yeah, probably. But yeah, this is a little bit different than the absolute war machine for the last couple of games of the NBA Finals. Like, partially just because they haven't had the need to. Like, we've been seeing more of cruise mode LeBron because he hasn't needed to.
Yeah,
be, I mean,
that
it
hasn't been against that level of competition. Although I will say that, like, that Warriors team, the last three games of the Finals was like pretty beaten down and broken. Like, that was not the same Warriors team. But I will say this. I mean, I think there's a couple things. So I do agree that LeBron, especially with the way he's hit the jump shot in these playoffs, has been playing at an unbelievable level. I mean, it's just these teams have no chance to stop him whatsoever. And then, not that they've played like great defensive teams yet, but, and there aren't that many great defensive teams in the league anymore, but I think that the Cavaliers are playing better than at any time since LeBron came to Cleveland. And I would even potentially include those last three games of the Finals, because, you know, that team, I think, was just not quite at the level. And Kevin Love has been awesome. He's been on fire. I think he's playing at a much higher level this year. than he was last year in the playoffs. I guess the only weak link right now has been Irving, who is quietly having a pretty subpar playoffs. And again, was quiet in this one with 11 points. But, you know, he's had a couple of big games when they've really needed him to, and that's what's mattered. I think he having him almost as like a little bit more out of the limelight, and then when they need some isolation scoring to go to him, as opposed to just like giving him 25 possessions a game automatically, I think is almost kind of better for them in some ways, because the LeBron plus shooters alignment is so difficult to deal with it on its own.
Yeah, I'd say that's fair. Yeah, I mean,
and by the way, Kyrie, I think he had one time where he got back cut in this game, but I didn't see any other instances of really bad defense, and the fact that they've been trapping has really opened that up a lot. And now that they have an engaged LeBron on the backside, that trapping is much more effective. And you know, we'll see how that works against Golden State. But Boston disappointed me in how well they dealt with that, but maybe we'd be saying they dealt with it a lot better if they had just made shots in the first half. I mean, they were so broke from everywhere. Even the free throw line, they're only 5 out of 10 in the first half.
And that's why I am excited for game two, just if because it's the best chance we probably have of seeing Boston getting a real another bite at that apple. And I think they'll do better, but whether better is enough is still an open question.
Yeah, I mean, well,
and we should also mention Cleveland was only 11 of 31 from three in this game too. It was balanced differently, but it wasn't like they were buzzsaws in that way. They were just getting a million layups.
All right, you want to talk a little all defense team? We're definitely late to this, but we haven't had a chance to get into this yet. I took the approach this year, I think it's pretty similar to what I did last year, and I know you didn't do it the same way, but you know, the NBA says two guards, two forwards, and a center. I like to be a little bit more specific than that. I like to pick guys who play a certain position on offense and, you know, then can guard that position and ideally others as well on defense. So, you know, if you're going to go with two guards and you're going to have like Avery Bradley and Tony Allen, it's like, that's not a real team. You know, you need someone who can actually, like, the value comes in actually like playing that position and guarding that position as well. And so I had a point guard, a shooting guard, a wing, you know, who can guard like really like wing scorers, and then I also had a position for combo, so a guy who plays at the three and the four, but if he needs to guard a traditional power forward, can you hold up okay in that matchup as well, and then of course just your traditional center option. So that's how I broke it down. Do you do it any differently? I'm guessing you do, because I thought this was kind of a unique approach for me.
I use a more rigid format of just kind of going through it in that perspective. And I had some issues this year in terms of positional definitions. And I was openly kind of questioning myself in terms of certain parts of it. And also it's hard because positional data is not always the most reliable, because it depends so much on the assumptions of specific individuals. And like, you, as you know, as our listeners know too, like assignments can change pretty quickly. So for example, Andre Robertson is a real challenge with this, because I feel like the forwards are stronger than the guards, but as a technical matter, because he started next to Oladipo and Russ, he was playing small forward most of the time. So I found myself in kind of an ethical quandary about how to handle that.
Yeah, I totally understand that as well. I had him in my wing position, which is basically the three. And this combo thing to add to that, you know, I put guys in, like, let's say Giannis Antetokounmpo, right? Like, he was started at the four for Milwaukee, doesn't generally guard the best wing scorer on the other team, but he's capable of doing that and switching, but he's also capable of guarding the power forward. You know, like LeBron, I would put in that category. Kevin Durant, even though he starts at the three for the Warriors, plays a lot of four for them as well. You know, KD is not really like going to be chasing guys around screens on pick and rolls. You know, it's guys who can do that, who can guard wings and ISOs, but now in the evolving NBA, you know, Marvin Williams would be another guy who's kind of in this category. In the evolving NBA, they are given more rim protection duties as well, more rebounding duties, more post defense duties as well. But anyway, on to the actual picks here. I thought that there are two point guards to me that were far and away first deserving of first and second team. Those were Chris Paul and Patrick Beverley. Chris Paul, number one. And the reason I think Chris Paul is so good, number one, the advanced stats, his metrics were unbelievable. I realize he missed 20 games, but I think he had one of the highest defensive RPMs in the league, and certainly the highest among point guards. And then the thing that sets him apart among basically all these other guys is he's just so strong and so tenacious that he can actually like switch one through three, which you probably don't see with these other guys. You know, even if he's got a guard like, you know, a Kevin Durant or something in the post, like he actually can do that okay, whereas the rest of these guys are just going to get totally steamrolled. So that's why I really emphasize the ability to switch more this year, and that might lead to some controversial opinions later on here, but that's why I had Chris Paul far and away first team, and then Beverly really the only guy anymore who's a starter that really like gets into guys anymore. You know, and I think a lot of the guys who are below him, you know, who would be honorable mention, Mike Conley, Ricky Rubio, Drew Holiday, George Hill probably would have been like my number three, but he just, you know, only played half the season. Eric Bledsoe has slipped a lot. Kyle Lowry has slipped a lot. John Wall has slipped a lot. There used to be some really good defensive point guards, and now really it seems like a lot of those guys have fallen off significantly to me.
It's also just the selection bias that teams need so much more offense now out of that position that you can't survive except for Patrick Beverley. And he does things offensively, but he also gets to play next to James Harden. So
yeah, I mean, he at least plays point guard on their second unit, you know, so sure. I agree with you. I kind of would have been a little bit skeptical of that given the fact that Harden was the one with the ball in his hands all the time, but he at least has enough point guard skills that, you know, he can do some stuff there.
Right.
And he hits shots as well. You know, he's not like an offensive zero.
So unlike you, I do not necessarily feel in a kind of a structural way that you have to have somebody who defends each position in your first team and second team, just because I think that sometimes that can be unfair, especially. Yeah.
It's more about plays each position on offense to me, actually, which I know it's the all defense team, but I think
that's a way of thinking about it.
Yeah. I want to have a team that you realistically like could assemble that like wouldn't just be like a total clown show on offense, you know, and not just because like you actually have someone to play each position on offense. Not that they actually are even good at offense, but they got to at least play that position incredibly to me.
I totally understand that argument. It's not the way that I conceive of the teams, just because I think sometimes that could lead to bias against players just unfairly.
I totally understand and dismiss that argument.
No, I don't dismiss it. I just don't follow it. And I think that. But what I was getting at with Chris Paul is I am an open skeptic of the importance of point guard defense compared to especially wings. But Chris Paul is so good at what he does that he made my first team anyway. Even though I don't have that requirement of having a point guard, he's that good that he makes it anyway.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive. And again, you know, just that ability to switch is really outstanding for me. At shooting guard, I had a lot more good contenders here. Danny Green was my first team guy. He is probably the best shooting guard in help defense. We've seen Danny Green fast break defense. His shot blocking at the rim is outstanding. He's strong enough to be a switch guy as well. He can play up a position and guard most wing guys, which, you know, a lot of these guys can't do that well. You know, you're looking at some of these guys are kind of more 1-2 defenders than, you know, 1-3 defenders. I really like ones who can guard or twos who can guard 1-3 at least. And then my second choice was Klay Thompson for that same reason, because he's able to switch. You think about this Warriors scheme, he makes that go in a way that is very underrated, because if he were just sort of some normal shooting guard who is pretty thin and couldn't switch, it doesn't work. You know, Klay Thompson actually holds up pretty well in the post against a lot of guys. He'll front. He's gotten a lot stronger in the last 2 years as well. You know, he guards point guards a lot of the time. He'll get the primary assignment on a guy like James Harden. He can switch on to someone like Kawhi Leonard or even LeBron James and do, you know, if not an unbelievable job, a credible job. And so just the ability to switch and maintain your defensive integrity and not get killed, that makes up for a lot more. I mean, Klay is not going to be like just locking down the way you see someone like Avery Bradley or KCP or Tony Allen doing, but just the additional versatility that he provides to be able to switch 2-4, even 2-5 sometimes in some matchups, like that's what really, you just prevent anyone from getting penetration. You just force their entire team to go one-on-one, and he's a very underrated part of the Warriors' ability to do that.
I'm a little bit surprised you didn't mention how he did on Gordon Hayward in the Jazz series. I thought that was an underrated part of what he can do, that he sometimes draws those base assignments to open things up, and that, you know, the Warriors change up who's guarding whom all the time. But I think that's another reflection of how he kind of bridges some of these gaps, and he's he's primarily guarding Patty Mills in the Spurs series. And so because Patty Mills is their greater threat kind of in those three spots with Kawhi out and in those two spots with Kawhi in. And so, and they'll throw him on Kawhi for moments of time as well. So I had Clay there too, but there are a lot of really talented guys.
Did he make your first team or was it Danny
second
Green?
Team? No, Danny okay, Green. So Danny Green's better.
We had the same guys then. They had Green yeah. and Thompson.
Different yeah. rationales, ended up with the same guys. Klay Thompson made my second team, and I was really torn on that last spot. As I said, I'm not married to it being a point guard because if I have Klay on, and so I have Klay on, and then the last spot was really for me between Patrick Beverley, who's certainly deserving of consideration, deserving getting it, Avery Bradley, Kentavious Caldwell-Pope, and the guy who I ended up giving it to, which is Tony Allen. I think Allen is just a monster defensively still, and actually played in more games than Patrick Beverley in the regular season. I mean, we lose sight of that a little bit just because of the timing of everything, but he did play in more games, and Tony Allen can still just erase guys in a way that Patrick Beverley makes guys frustrated. Tony Allen can sometimes make them disappear, and I love that.
Well, not only that, but Allen is just, he shows up for steals in places that just no one expects him to.
Yeah, he's way better as a help defender than Avery Bradley.
Yeah, that's true too. I think maybe I wasn't giving him as much credit. I think it's just the overall number of minutes that he played was so much lower than someone like Bradley or KCP. You know, he's 35, he's playing like 22 minutes a game or something at this point. Now, you know what, actually I'm being a little unfair to him. He was all the way up at 27 this year. I still would probably go with Avery Bradley. It would have been higher to me than him. You know, he would have been my, and then Allen maybe would have been an honorable mention as well, and KCP. And there's definitely some very solid shooting guards in the league defensively. And I do think, though, that Allen as a help defender, also as a switch guy, is probably better than Avery Bradley. But we saw what Avery Bradley was able to do. Basically, like, you know, when he was guarding Bradley Beal, for example, he erased him, and then they moved Thomas onto him, and he took John Wall, and, you know, Beal started going off. But yeah, I'm probably giving it not enough credit to Tony Allen here, and maybe penalizing him unfairly for his offense, because yeah, I really didn't realize that he played 27 minutes a game this year. So he still doesn't beat out Thompson to me, but he's definitely would be probably my next choice at the shooting guard at this point.
So we could move on to the wings. That's how you have it defined. That's kind of the transition into my forwards. And do you want to go through position by position, or just because both of us had our top three for defensive player of the year just happened to fill the top three spots for this?
You mean with forwards and centers remaining?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so I guess it's easier for me to do it by position because the way I had it set out. Kawhi Leonard was number one for me. I know his numbers weren't as good, but there was that fluky three-point defense that affected things. He was outstanding against James Harden. I thought his ability to get over screens basically allowed the strategy of them leaving the big back so Harden couldn't just kill them from either mid-range or the three-point line. You know, his length, his strength, he really, I think, wore down Harden, even though he didn't play in that game six. So he would be up there. For me, he's a clear number one. And then below him, I thought it was actually a five-way race between Andre Robertson, Robert Covington, Andre Iguodala, Jimmy Butler, and Paul George. Iguodala came on more late in the year, but didn't play as many minutes as some of these other guys. Butler and George, I thought both slipped. Neither of their defenses were really as good. Covington looked great by some of the advanced metrics, but he was not quite at this level, you know, over a long period of time. And so I give a little extra credit for that, especially because some of the defensive numbers can be fluky in a one-year sample. If you remember, like, Chris Middleton was like the greatest two-way player ever, and, you know, I think he's a pretty average wing defender at this point. So that leaves Robertson, who is probably the best of all those guys protecting the rim. Excellent defensive rebounder, which of course is part of this, and just his length. He's probably the best of these guys at guarding ones. Like, he can really guard one through four, probably the most of any of these guys. So all of that is why I ended up going with Robertson, but very difficult to decide between all those guys for my second wing spot, which would be, you know, basically think of that as second team forward for one of those forward spots, and Kawhi Leonard being first team for one of the forward spots.
I had the exact same struggle, and a big part of it was that I wanted Robertson to get one of the shooting guard spots, but he only played, according to Basketball Reference, and again, this gets into the positional definition thing, he only played 8% of his his minutes there. And that's not enough for me to really feel comfortable with it. And again, they could be defining it strangely. They could be saying it because he bounces around positions, but that's a little bit.
I don't think they are. I mean, times when he was playing at the two in Oklahoma City, I can't think of many lineups that they regularly deployed where that would have been the case.
Yeah, and even then, I don't think they loved, though they did it sometimes, having Victor Oladipo on threes. So, you know, they would do it if the situation presented itself. It just so happens that a lot of the best perimeter players right now at the swingman positions are the three. But Robertson had a wonderful year. He's also can be a nice rebounder for his position. And I ended up going with Covington for that, what ends up being my second team spot, because I use the different rationale. I really like his ability to, you know, the kind of the block steal combo guys are something that I always really like. And Covington doing a little bit more of the forward stuff helped him for me, because the Sixers need that. You know, they need players who can kind of fill that role. And maybe that's a little bit unfair to Robertson just because they have Steven Adams back there a fair amount. But I think that Covington did a nice job handling what they needed to. And the defensive talent around Covington in terms of quality shifted so regularly and so dramatically over the course of the season. I mean, they were monsters when Joel Embiid was there. They were distinctly not when he was not. But Covington was helpful the entire time.
Yeah, the one reason I might put Covington a little bit below some of these guys is just because, and this isn't even necessarily, I don't realize it's a regular season award, but I get a better feel for guys' defense in a playoff series when they really do have to just match up and stop the best wing scorers. And we've seen Iguodala and Butler and Paul George be effective in that role. We've obviously seen that with Leonard and Covington, since his teams haven't been competing for the playoffs. You know, we haven't really seen that spotlight get put on him yet, although, you know, I think he did about everything that he could during the regular season. I mean, I think he's kind of, I don't know that I put him in the same category as the rest of these guys as a lockdown guy. I think as a help guy, his ability to close out, you know, that kind of stuff, I think he did really well this year. I'll move on now to my combo forwards. Draymond Green is my defensive player of the year. He is number one on this list for me. But then it came down to, I had basically a three-way race between Paul Millsap, Giannis Antetokounmpo, and Kevin Durant. LeBron, if we were talking about first team all defense in the playoffs, he'd be much more in consideration. I eventually went with Paul Millsap. He's been doing it for longer. He was part of a great Hawks defense and really is just an underrated defensive force. So he was my other second team all defense forward. Where were you on those guys?
I had Draymond defensive player of the year as well. And the Hawks were just a fascinating team defensively this year, because you kind of try to piece together why they were so good. And, you know, they have plenty of defensive talent. Dwight Howard had a better season than I expected at center. But I think Millsap is so important to what they do. And the fact that they were able to change over their centers and still be, and you know, have a very different team and still be good there helped out. And again, I've talked about the idea that I like steel box guys, and Paul Millsap is certainly that. So I had him second, but you're right that it is an intriguing group. And the other reason why I think Millsap stands above those guys is that he brings it more game to game. Like Giannis and Durant, they have their moments. And if we're talking capability, of course, LeBron is probably number two on this list to Draymond, maybe even number one. And that's something different. Capability, like I kind of use that argument a little bit in favor of Kawhi, but Kawhi is a different case. And so for me, it's Millsap. And then, well, I didn't define him this way, so the other one. So, but Millsap is my second team all defense guy in a similar niche to what you had.
Yeah, it looks like we're actually ending up pretty similarly here. At center, Rudy Gobert was my number two defensive player of the year. He easily takes the top spot. I believe he was number one in defensive RPM. Draymond was number two. Gobert has been outstanding now for 3 years, even when he had that MCL injury last year. The Jazz completely cratered defensively. I mean, he, without Derek Favors playing for much of the year, Gobert actually really propped up their defense that really was, and without George Hill playing a lot too. I mean, if you look at the four men they played, Boris Diaw, Trey Lyles, and Joe Johnson were their four men all year. So it's not like they were exactly sending a lot of help his way. Where it really got interesting for me was second team all defense at center. There are not as many defensively dominant centers as there used to be. We've talked about DeAndre Jordan, but he, to me, is just too inconsistent. I thought we saw that in the playoffs. I thought we saw that throughout the year again. Joel Embiid, if he'd been even close to healthy all year, he would have been an easy pick for second team for me. But, you know, of course, he only played under 1,000 minutes, so hard to give it to him. Dwight Howard, I thought, started off the year very nicely. He had a really excellent game, for example, in Golden State earlier in the year. He had another great game against the Cavs when they beat Cleveland in Cleveland. But he really dropped off, and it seemed like his back or his knees were really bothering him by the end of the year. But still had a nice overall year. And that actually leaves Anthony Davis, who I thought had a renaissance year defensively, played more than half of his minutes at center. The Pels were a quality defense. So he's got more mobility, more use as a switch guy than a fair amount of these guys as well. So I ended up going with him, but you know, none of those guys I mentioned to me are anywhere close to my first team guy, Gobert.
I really stressed out about this for a while because there was nobody that I thought, when I went through it kind of on first blush, was really deserving. And part of this is also the little bit of bias from the playoffs, because Dwight Howard was much better overall in the regular season, but the lasting impression of was him being a stone statue in the playoffs. This is
why we need to do this earlier next year, by the way. Like, I probably didn't give Tony Allen enough credit because, you know, he just missed the playoffs, and he kind of like, I was like, oh, you know, he probably didn't play that much. And I was like, oh no, actually, how about you go look at like the stats from this year and see how much he played instead of just like trying to remember it. But and Howard is another example of how that can really affect things.
So I think that was kind of where I was going with the initial stuff. I also want to mention, you brought up Joel Embiid. They had a defensive rating under 100 when Joel Embiid was on the floor this year, 99.1, which is, considering the rest of their talent, is awfully impressive. And we'll have to see what happens moving forward. He did only play in 31 games, so maybe some of that stuff will not continue. And like you, I went in this circuitous route, and I actually was originally removing Anthony Davis from consideration because I was thinking, because you focus on the end of the year and you're like, oh, you know, he's playing power forward next to DeMarcus Cousins and they weren't that good defensively. And then I just sat there and realized, because I had gotten into this argument with various people on Twitter, including people I respect a lot, about that were kind of trying to argue that Anthony Davis should be a power forward in terms of all NBA because he was playing center at the end of the year. And I'm like, no, you look at the whole sample. And then I went back and looked, and he played a majority of his minutes at center. And as of the All-Star break, they were eighth in defense. And remember, they fiddled around with a lot of other lineups in the early part of that year. When they went on their big push, it was with AD at center. So I ended up going with him and feel pretty happy about it. I went from being dissatisfied with this whole process to being like, okay, I can live with that.
All right, well, that was cool. Let's talk about the Washington Wizards offseason momentarily. But first, this from Betterment. It's never too late to save for retirement or your other financial goals. If you're getting married, you want to buy a house or a car. And the financial services industry has now embraced technology with the entry of automated investing. That's what Betterment does. It's lower cost automated investing than traditional financial services because you don't have to pay a human for expertise that a lot of research has shown doesn't really give you that much in a lot of cases. They have a bunch of cool products, a few of which I can tell you about. One is Smart Deposit, where if you get a certain amount in your checking account, you can say, all right, anytime I get above $5,000 in my checking account, that's all I need for day-to-day expenses. Let's invest the rest of it anytime I get more. So especially if you're a freelancer, you have variable income, that's a great way to deal with things. Another one is their tax impact preview. If you're going to make a move with your investments, it'll tell you what the tax consequences of that will be. And that's another great service that they offer. Well, you get started with them, betterment.com/capspace. You can check them out. They have a really cool, simple user interface that helps even investing neophytes get going. And Dunked On listeners can get up to 6 months of no fees. You can learn how at betterment.com/capspace. Once again, betterment.com/capspace. Betterment, investing made better. So Washington doesn't really have a ton going on this offseason in terms of intrigue. I mean, it just seems pretty obvious to me. They've got Otto Porter as a restricted free agent. They're probably going to have to pay him, if not the max, close to it. That's going to put them close to the tax. So they're not really going to be able to do much else other than that. And if they were to re-sign Porter at the max, then they're basically like right at the tax at that point. Washington, one of the few teams, I think there's like three or four of them now, that have never paid the tax, first under Abe Pollin and now Ted Leonsis. But they haven't really had a team worth paying the tax for either. Maybe you could make the argument that this would be that. And so I do think they need to add to this team, but they will be extremely constrained in doing so.
Even if they want to spend, it's going to be hard for them. And I think that this is a year that they should go into the tax. If you're willing to at some point, it might as well be now. And a big part of the reason is that's how they're going to get better. You know, they can hold firm and stay pretty close to the line. But if they want to use their taxpayer mid-level exception, which would be a nice use of spending for them, they need to be able to be willing to do that, because then they can bring Bogdanović back. They can sign a backup point guard. And ideally, I would add some wing depth, depending on how they see Kelly Oubre. And they can make all that happen with the new mid-level if they can get, and presumably getting a guy at the minimum on the other side of it. But they're going to need to spend to do so. And they don't really have that much movable salary because they have all these guys on kind of mid-level contracts, you know, like Markieff Morris, Marcin Gortat. And they could move one of those guys if they really had to, but you're going to
be. And they also need those guys. Yeah, I mean, exactly. That's the other problem. Like, those guys are starting for them. You know, they don't have despite all the money they spent, they don't have a ton of depth. The one downside to me of if you're going to spend the mini mid-level this year, which it starts at $5.2 million per season, so you're basically looking at about a 3-year, $60 million contract, is none of their money really going into the future is going away in future years. Like, Jason Smith has a player option for next year. Other than that, like, that's really the only thing that might be coming off the books anytime soon. And with Brandon Jennings a free agent, they probably don't even have really a great option at point guard. Trey Burke is a restricted free agent. I would imagine he probably isn't even going to get a qualifying offer because he might just take it, and then, you know, you're kind of stuck with him. So I wouldn't necessarily do that. I mean, they're clearly not going to want to pay him, you know, some kind of a decent contract if they're going to re-sign him in restricted free agency. I probably would just totally not give him a qualifying offer. Satoransky, I think he could be solid, but Brooks doesn't trust him yet. So they do need to get some other kind of veteran point guard option in. We'll see. That backup point guard market is looking pretty tepid right now as far as like the type of players you can bring in who are actually going to be able to contribute in the playoffs.
I had two guys in mind, not necessarily that could contribute in the playoffs, but Ty Lawson and CJ Watson. I think if you're looking for somebody who's really only going to play like 5 to 10 minutes a game, I think that could
play more than that. It's just, you know, he defensively could get taken advantage of, but so did Jennings. At least I think Lawson can give you more offensively just in terms of running the team. If they are going to spend that taxpayer mid-level, I think their number one lead is to get another wing, even if it's a very defense first guy, like someone like a Tabo Cephalosha or Lukumba Mute. Because I mean, this team now, you know, they're in theory going to be in the playoffs. They look like a team that, health permitting, can be in the top four in the East for a while. And so you got to start thinking more now about playoff matchups. And they really have nobody. They avoided the Cavs this year. They got nobody who can guard LeBron James, nobody who can guard like a Paul George or a Jimmy Butler. And so to get someone like that, who then also might enable you, you know, Oubre is going to be too thin to do that, I think. To get someone like that who would then enable you to play small more at the end of games as well, with Markieff Morris, we saw how they just could not guard the Celtics shooting, for example. Imagine how bad that would get with Cleveland. And Gortat is not like enough of a post-up guy that he can kill that spacing on the other end. We saw, you know, Olynyk, for example, like just worked these guys, whereas if you have guys who can switch more, maybe you don't need that. So that would be my number one priority for them. Obviously something at backup point guard, or just like you just say, hey, you know what, we're gonna just give this job to Tomas Satoransky, and then if we need to make an upgrade at the trade deadline, and we will, or maybe even in the buyout market, like that would be my strategy. Try to get more of a wing defender, and I mentioned Cephalosha and Mbamute. Like, those are the only guys I think that are really good defenders that might be available in their price range. And then if not that, I would go for like a combo forward type, you know, a Jonas Jerebko, a Dante Cunningham, again, someone who can just be like okay defensively, shoot a little bit, not kill you on offense, just give you a little more depth, because they really need like a someone who can come in and play some backup four who isn't a traditional big.
I hadn't even considered Mbamute just because I thought his price range was going to be higher, but if he were in that
range,
you think
he'll get more than $5 million a year?
I'm not sure he will. My brain was going more towards seven, but Washington would be a wonderful fit just because he could be kind of the third piece of a three-man forward rotation. I think he could work really nicely there, and that could actually open some stuff up for Markieff Morris as well on the second unit
or Markieff could play center. You could play Luke at the four. You have enough offense to get away with a guy like that, and then just have him guard the LeBron Jameses of the world, and I think, you know, do an okay job, have someone who just isn't going to get completely steamrolled role the way someone like Otto Porter would.
Yeah, I was thinking that maybe it's just because I was underrating the idea of the Wizards maybe even getting somebody for a little bit less. I was thinking more aiming low, just because thinking they're like somebody more in the Matt Barnes type of range, which is not appetizing compared to what you were discussing. Just we'll have to see where the market, what the market bears out. But another guy we should mention here, not necessarily saying he's a solution, but they did acquire Chris McCullough in that Brooklyn trade, which is also why they don't have a first round pick. And he could be a part of the bench solution next year. I haven't seen enough of him to have a feel for it, but he's an option.
Yeah, I don't think he is. And, you know, I'm not even going to say that, like, in watching him, it's like, oh, he's been horrendous or something. I mean, the guy played, what, like 61 minutes for Brooklyn? And I mean, if he probably played less than that for Washington. So I wouldn't be counting on him for anything. We'll put it that way. Like moving him into a role. I mean, he could be that kind of backup combo for, but it just seems like he is so incredibly far away at this point that relying on him. We haven't talked at all about Bojan Bogdanović as well, who is a restricted free agent. $7 million cap hold. Doesn't really matter what his cap hold is, you know, but they keep that on the book. So they could pay him whatever they want to. They have full bird rights on him. He's restricted. 28 years old. He shot the ball well. You know, I think he's had some moments even in the playoffs shooting the ball. He's someone who can contribute for them. They do need some more scoring off the bench. But then it seems to me like they're probably in a situation where they have to decide, are we either going to use the mini mid-level or are we going to bring him back? Because the contract that he's going to get seems like it would be to me like kind of right around the mini mid-level, maybe a little bit more if they're going to go with less years, maybe a little bit more on a per dollar basis, or I'm sorry, on a per year basis.
They also are kind of at the whim of what happens with the market. I think about a situation like what happened with Timofey Mozgov last year, where it only takes one team to misread a market and like your guy better than the similar players that are on other teams. Like Shabazz Muhammad is not the same guy as Bogdanović, but you could see a team saying, oh, this guy, we can make him work. And then the other one just gets way less money. And the Wizards just hope that nobody loves their guy. And the prospect of them matching could scare other teams off, just because it matters a lot more in some ways at these lower levels than at the higher levels, because at the higher levels, it's just a risk worth taking. You know, if you're the Nets or the Sixers, taking that shot on KCP is very different from doing it on somebody like Bogdanović. So they could see the market chill enough, but as a practical matter, I think you're right. I wish that were not the choice, but with the cap largely stalling at this point and Washington having no dissipation in their money, it would be hard to believe that they would commit that kind of thing to two different guys, even though I think that's close to necessary to reach the level they want to reach. And it certainly would be wonderful if Jan Bohemia played well enough this year that they could trade Gortat and feel good about it, and then they could solve both of these problems. But Gortat has been far better, and Gortat has been far more trustworthy.
Yeah, Gortat in his exit interviews with Candace Buckner on Tuesday had some comments basically saying like, hey, you know, and he's never one to shy away from being honest in the media, which I love about him, but saying, hey, you know, like I need to have a conversation with Ernie Grunfeld about like, are they going to trade me? You know, they brought in Jan Mahimi underneath me. What's going on? But, you know, they can't trade him. You know, they don't. And even if they, number one, they can't trade him because they need him. And number two, even if they wanted to, you know, I'm not really sure that anyone really needs him. You know, I think he, because of his screening ability, both because Bradley Beal uses screen so much, John Wall as well, especially because Wall, you know, is a guy who's not the greatest shooter. So he needs to have that chemistry with Gortat. You know, and I thought they're off. Offense really suffered in that Boston series when Gortat was off the floor and they didn't have his screening ability against some of the best guards. Again, we're talking about getting into the playoffs here. I mean, maybe an option that they could try. I mean, because, you know, we're talking about potentially getting off of money here, but, you know, I think this is definitely not the year to cheap out if they can open up the coffers even a little bit. But this is a team that's long been one of the least profitable in the NBA. Maybe they'll get some more season tickets now after this nice run this year. But if they could find a way to trade Gortat for someone with a little more defensive versatility and then maybe throw in an asset as well. But you got to remember now this year and then in 2015, both, or I'm sorry, 2016 and 2017 now, they'll have traded away their first round pick and they did the same to get Gortat. So this is now three of the last 4 years they have not had their first rounder. Really the only guy they have on a rookie contract right now, other than McCullough, who was a dump, is Kelly Oubre. And he's obviously going to have to step up more in future years. But but you really start to say we can't just keep trading away our draft picks for these kind of incremental improvements. So I don't know if you'd want to do that, but it is something maybe to consider if there's a more versatile big man making similar money that they could try to acquire. I'm not even sure who that would be necessarily, but maybe you could get like another guy who could be more of a combo big, start Mahinmi, and then, you know, he could come off the bench behind Morris at either big spot.
I can't think of the right fit. I toyed with the idea of Ed Davis a little bit, but they don't have the
yeah, he's way, not better than Gortat, though.
No, no. So. But they also don't have the mechanism to fit in like one of those mid salaries. They have a trade exception for Nicholson, but it's not big enough. And it's just another team building thing. And also, of course, you know, the idea of costing money and everything like that. So unless they were getting that guy back in a trade or getting a trade exception, it would be hard.
Yeah, I think probably my plan would be, you know, especially if they feel like Mahinmi is healthy going forward, that these knee troubles are behind him. I know he had the cap issue in the playoffs, but that's a little bit less concerning. I think my plan would be either to move Jason Smith and his $5.3 million this year, $5.5 million player option next year. See if I could move him now, because I don't think he's going to play nearly as well as he did this season. And maybe a team would just be willing to take him. And if not, then maybe you could just keep him around. And then, you know, if it still looks like Mahinmi has passed his troubles, you could try to get under the tax or close to it. They also have the 57th or 52nd pick this year. They traded their first away to Brooklyn, but they are light on second rounders going forward. They owe them in 2019 and 2021. Are any other housekeeping in terms of just guys who are like non-guaranteed at the back of the roster?
Yeah, I believe that both Sheldon McClellan and Daniel Ochefu are non-guaranteed and have early guarantee dates, so we'll know on them probably right at the start of free agency.
Yeah, they become 50,000 guaranteed as of July 1st. So we may see them just get cut before then. And hey, you know, it doesn't seem like the kind of guys who had that much demand. They could always just re-sign those guys to a fully non-guaranteed deal later just to save that 50K. At least, you know, every bit's going to count off the luxury tax for this team. Or, you know, they might keep them around. McClellan had a few moments every now and then this year. Ochefu, we didn't see hardly any of him at all, so it's difficult to imagine that he's ready to contribute. They haven't had a D-League team, so we haven't seen how they've performed there. I could also see them stretching McCullough as well if they just, you know, we'll see how he plays in summer league this year. But, you know, after that, he does have his third-year rookie option that's already been picked up, but his fourth year, they could move on from again because they're so impacted salary-wise.
Or he could even be one of those CJ Wilcox situations where they don't like him and just give him to somebody else.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely seemed like when the Nets traded him, it was basically as dead salary. Like, no, I don't think either the Wizards or the Nets valued him in that trade necessarily. But, you know, maybe he could still come through. He's young. He's still had that ACL in college, so he another year removed from that, can shoot it a little bit. He's got some nice straight line speed. Last thing, though, the All-NBA announcements, which are coming out tomorrow, John Wall, a guy who's not been talked about, he actually is eligible for the designated player veteran extension. And by the way, I'm correcting this because I messed up his years of service. He still has 2 years left on his deal, though, but because he does have 8 years of experience, he can get a designated veteran extension that's only 4 years and would start after his current contract ends. He doesn't have a player option the way Paul George does. So the Wizards could definitely give him that. That would start at about $36 million and tack on 4 years and maybe about $155 million to his existing contract. We won't know the exact number until we get the cap number for the 2019-20 season. But you wonder whether they would necessarily want to do that with Wall 29 at that point for these guys who are kind of between the 10th and 20th best player in the league, like Wall is. That's not going to be a great contract for seasons 29 through 32. But Wall certainly would be aggrieved if they don't offer that to him, because they already eschewed giving him a bump with the renegotiation and extension last year to sign the likes of Jason Smith and Mahinmi, guys who didn't really perform that well this year. Smith was okay. Mahinmi obviously wasn't. And Andrew Nicholson, who had to get dumped as a bad contract already. So that'll be some more drama for the Wizards this offseason. All right, I think we are done here. Once again, congratulations to Ellie on his graduation from Georgetown Law. If anyone else wants to send a message to their friends, feel free to get in touch with me. Email address is in my Twitter bio. And of course, betterment.com/capspace. You can get up to 6 months of no fees for lower cost automated investing. We did, even though it was a boring game, our dunk down video today. You can check that out on either Twitter or my Facebook page, Nate Duncan NBA. You can subscribe to that YouTube channel. Twitter NBA show is off tomorrow, of course. We'll be back with that for game two on Friday. And no Dunked On tomorrow, but there will be a all mailbag, our first exclusive Patreon podcast for our subscribers, whom we thank. If you are a subscriber, you can ask questions, and they're the only ones who are going to get to hear that. So we hope that you will subscribe, help support this endeavor, help support the hours of content we're doing on Twitter NBA show as well. We certainly appreciate that, and we try to give you some extras. In fact, I'm about to post, as soon as we get off of this podcast, my salary sheet that I just used for this. So that's another little perk that you'll get, salary sheets for all 30 teams. I'll post eventually. Eventually, with some of my projections and cap holds, a little bit more detailed than some of the stuff that's publicly available. So, all right, that's it. Anything to add, Danny, before we go?
Well, I had my offseason preview for the Lakers come out on Wednesday for Sports Illustrated, and I might have another one come out. They have a batch of them, and so we'll see if they send one out. I'm actually writing the Oklahoma City Thunder one now, so that won't be tomorrow, but that'll be coming up soon, probably.
We really need to start spreading these plugs out throughout the show now. Like, we just have like too much shit. We're all working too hard right now. But only another 2 months, and then we'll get a little time off finally. But it's the two best months of the year to me, so looking forward to it. And thank you so much for listening. We'll talk to you all hopefully tomorrow if you're a Patreon subscriber. If not, then we'll talk to you all on Friday night. Till then.